The long voyage. When the wind is blowing and the sleet or rain is driving against the dark windows, I love to sit by the fire, thinking of what I have read in books of voyage and travel. Such books have had a strong fascination for my mind from my earliest childhood, and I wonder it should have come to pass that I never have been round the world, never have been shipwrecked, ice environed, tomahawked, or eaten. Sitting on my ruddy hearth in the twilight of New Year's Eve, I find incidents of travel rise around me from all the latitudes and longitudes of the globe. They observe no order or sequence, but appear and vanish as they will, come like shadows, so depart. Columbus, alone upon the sea with his disaffected crew, looks over the waste of waters from his high station on the poop of his ship, and sees the first uncertain glimmer of light, rising and falling with the waves, like a torch in the bark of some fisherman, which is the shining star of a new world. Bruce is caged in Abyssinia, surrounded by the gory horrors which shall often startle him out of his sleep at home when years have passed away. Franklin, come to the end of his unhappy overland journey, would that it had been his last, lies perishing of hunger with his brave companions, each emaciated figure stretched upon its miserable bed without the power to rise, all, dividing the weary days between their prayers, their remembrances of the dear ones at home, and conversation on the pleasures of eating, the last-named topic being ever present to them, likewise, in their dreams. All the African travelers, wayworn, solitary and sad, submit themselves again to drunken, murderous, man-selling despots, of the lowest order of humanity, and Mungo Park, fainting under a tree and succored by a woman, gratefully remembers how his good Samaritan has always come to him in woman's shape, the wide world over. A shadow on the wall in which my mind's eye can discern some traces of a rocky sea ghost, recalls to me a fearful story of travel derived from that unpromising narrator of such stories, a parliamentary blue book. A convict is its chief figure, and this man escapes with other prisoners from a penal settlement. It is an island, and they seize a boat, and get to the mainland. Their way is by a rugged and precipitous seashore, and they have no earthly hope of ultimate escape, for the party of soldiers dispatched by an easier course to cut them off, must inevitably arrive at their distant bourne long before them, and retake them if by any hazard they survive the horrors of the way. Famine, as they all must have foreseen, besets them early in their course. Some of the party die and are eaten, some are murdered by the rest and eaten. This one awful creature eats his fill, and sustains his strength, and lives on to be recaptured and taken back. The unrelatable experiences through which he has passed have been so tremendous, that he is not hanged as he might be, but goes back to his old chain gang work. A little time, and he tempts one other prisoner away, seizes another boat, and flies once more, necessarily in the old hopeless direction, for he can take no other. He is soon cut off, and met by the pursuing party face to face, upon the beach. He is alone. In his former journey he acquired an inappeasable relish for his dreadful food. He urged the new man away, expressly to kill him and eat him. In the pockets on one side of his coarse convict dress, are portions of the man's body, on which he is regaling, in the pockets on the other side is an untouched store of salted pork, stolen before he left the island, for which he has no appetite. He is taken back, and he is hanged. But I shall never see that sea beach on the wall or in the fire, without him, solitary monster, eating as he prowls along, while the sea rages and rises at him. Captain Bligh, a worse man to be entrusted with arbitrary power there could scarcely be, is handed over the side of the Bounty, and turned adrift on the wide ocean in an open boat, by order of Fletcher Christian, one of his officers, at this very minute. Another flash of my fire, and Thursday October Christian, 25 years of age, son of the dead and gone Fletcher by a savage mother, leaps aboard His Majesty's ship Britain, hove to off Pitcairn's Island, says his simple grace before eating, in good English, and knows that a pretty little animal on board is called a dog, because in his childhood he had heard of such strange creatures from his father and the other mutineers, grown grey under the shade of the breadfruit trees, speaking of their lost country far away. See the house well, East Indiaman outward bound, driving madly on a January night towards the rocks near Seacombe, on the island of Purbeck. The captain's two dear daughters are aboard, and five other ladies. The ship has been driving many hours, has 7 feet water in her hold, and her mainmast has been cut away. The description of her loss, familiar to me from my early boyhood, seems to be read aloud as she rushes to her destiny. About 2 in the morning of Friday the 6th of January, the ship still driving, and approaching very fast to the shore, Mr. Henry Meriton, the second mate, went again into the cuddy, where the captain then was. Another conversation taking place, Captain Pierce expressed extreme anxiety for the preservation of his beloved daughters, and earnestly asked the officer if he could devise any method of saving them. On his answering with great concern, that he feared it would be impossible, but that their only chance would be to wait for morning, the captain lifted up his hands in silent and distressful ejaculation. At this dreadful moment, the ship struck, with such violence as to dash the heads of those standing in the cuddy against the deck above them, and the shock was accompanied by a shriek of horror that burst at one instant from every quarter of the ship. Many of the seamen, who had been remarkably inattentive and remiss in their duty during great part of the storm, now poured upon deck, where no exertions of the officers could keep them, while their assistance might have been useful. They had actually skulked in their hammocks, leaving the working of the pumps and other necessary labors to the officers of the ship, and the soldiers, who had made uncommon exertions. Roused by a sense of their danger, the same seamen, at this moment, in frantic exclamations, demanded of heaven and their fellow sufferers that succor which their own efforts, timely made, might possibly have procured. The ship continued to beat on the rocks, and soon bilging, fell with her broadside towards the shore. When she struck, a number of the men climbed up the ensign staff, under an apprehension of her immediately going to pieces. Mr. Meriton, at this crisis, offered to these unhappy beings the best advice which could be given. He recommended that all should come to the side of the ship lying lowest on the rocks, and singly to take the opportunities which might then offer, of escaping to the shore. Having thus provided, to the utmost of his power, for the safety of the desponding crew, he returned to the roundhouse, where, by this time, all the passengers and most of the officers had assembled. The latter were employed in offering consolation to the unfortunate ladies, and, with unparalleled magnanimity, suffering their compassion for the fair and amiable companions of their misfortunes to prevail over the sense of their own danger. In this charitable work of comfort, Mr. Meriton now joined, by assurances of his opinion, that the ship would hold together till the morning, when all would be safe. Captain Pierce, observing one of the young gentlemen loud in his exclamations of terror, and frequently cry that the ship was parting, cheerfully bid him be quiet, remarking that though the ship should go to pieces, he would not, but would be safe enough. It is difficult to convey a correct idea of the scene of this deplorable catastrophe, without describing the place where it happened. The hailswell struck on the rocks at a part of the shore where the cliff is of vast height, and rises almost perpendicular from its base. But at this particular spot, the foot of the cliff is excavated into a cavern of 10 or 12 yards in depth, and of breadth equal to the length of a large ship. The sides of the cavern are so nearly upright, as to be of extremely difficult access, and the bottom is strewed with sharp and uneven rocks, which seem, by some convulsion of the earth, to have been detached from its roof. The ship lay with her broadside opposite to the mouth of this cavern, with her whole length stretched almost from side to side of it. But when she struck, it was too dark for the unfortunate persons on board to discover the real magnitude of the danger, and the extreme horror of such a situation. In addition to the company already in the roundhouse, they had admitted 3 black women and 2 soldiers' wives, who, with the husband of one of them, had been allowed to come in, though the seamen, who had tumultuously demanded entrance to get the lights, had been opposed and kept out by Mr. Rogers and Mr. Bramay, the 3rd and 5th mates. The numbers there were, therefore, now increased to near 50. Captain Pierce sat on a chair, a cot, or some other movable, with a daughter on each side, whom he alternately pressed to his affectionate breast. The rest of the melancholy assembly were seated on the deck, which was strewed with musical instruments, and the wreck of furniture and other articles. Here also Mr. Meriton, after having cut several wax candles in pieces, and stuck them up in various parts of the roundhouse, and lighted up all the glass lanthorns he could find, took his seat, intending to wait the approach of dawn, and then assist the partners of his dangers to escape. But, observing that the poor ladies appeared parched and exhausted, he brought a basket of oranges and prevailed on some of them to refresh themselves by sucking a little of the juice. At this time they were all tolerably composed, except Miss Mansell, who was in hysteric fits on the floor of the deck of the roundhouse. But on Mr. Meriton's return to the company, he perceived a considerable alteration in the appearance of the ship. The sides were visibly giving way, the deck seemed to be lifting, and he discovered other strong indications that she could not hold much longer together. On this account, he attempted to go forward to look out, but immediately saw that the ship had separated in the middle, and that the forepart, having changed its position, lay rather further up towards the sea. In such an emergency, when the next moment might plunge him into eternity, he determined to seize the present opportunity, and follow the example of the crew and the soldiers, who were now quitting the ship in numbers, and making their way to the shore, though quite ignorant of its nature and description. Among other expedients, the ensign staff had been unshipped, and attempted to be laid between the ship's side and some of the rocks, but without success, for it snapped asunder before it reached them. However, by the light of a lanthorn, which a seaman handed through the skylight of the roundhouse to the deck, Mr. Meriden discovered a spar which appeared to be laid from the ship's side to the rocks, and on this spar he resolved to attempt his escape. Accordingly, lying down upon it, he thrust himself forward. However, he soon found that it had no communication with the rock. He reached the end of it, and then slipped off, receiving a very violent bruise in his fall, and before he could recover his legs, he was washed off by the surge. He now supported himself by swimming, until a returning wave dashed him against the back part of the cavern. Here he laid hold of a small projection in the rock, but was so much benumbed that he was on the point of quitting it, when a seaman, who had already gained a footing, extended his hand, and assisted him until he could secure himself a little on the rock, from which he clambered on a shelf still higher, and out of the reach of the surf. Mr. Rogers, the third mate, remained with the captain and the unfortunate ladies and their companions nearly 20 minutes after Mr. Meriden had quitted the ship. Soon after the latter left the roundhouse, the captain asked what was become of him, to which Mr. Rogers replied, that he was gone on deck to see what could be done. After this, a heavy sea breaking over the ship, the ladies exclaimed, "Oh, poor Meriden! He is drowned. Had he stayed with us he would have been safe." And they all, particularly Miss Mary Pierce, expressed great concern at the apprehension of his loss. The sea was now breaking in at the fore part of the ship, and reached as far as the mainmast. Captain Pierce gave Mr. Rogers a nod, and they took a lamp and went together into the stern gallery, where, after viewing the rocks for some time, Captain Pierce asked Mr. Rogers if he thought there was any possibility of saving the girls, to which he replied, he feared there was none, for they could only discover the black face of the perpendicular rock, and not the cavern which afforded shelter to those who escaped. They then returned to the roundhouse, where Mr. Rogers hung up the lamp, and Captain Pierce sat down between his two daughters. The sea continuing to break in very fast, Mr. McManus, a midshipman, and Mr. Schutz, a passenger, asked Mr. Rogers what they could do to escape. "Follow me," he replied, and they all went into the stern gallery, and from thence to the upper quarter gallery on the poop. While there, a very heavy sea fell on board, and the roundhouse gave way. Mr. Rogers heard the ladies shriek at intervals, as if the water reached them, the noise of the sea at other times drowning their voices. Mr. Bremay had followed him to the poop, where they remained together about 5 minutes, when on the breaking of this heavy sea, they jointly seized a hen coop. The same wave which proved fatal to some of those below, carried him and his companion to the rock, on which they were violently dashed and miserably bruised. Here on the rock were 27 men, but it now being low water, and as they were convinced that on the flowing of the tide all must be washed off, many attempted to get to the back or the sides of the cavern, beyond the reach of the returning sea. Scarcely more than 6, besides Mr. Rogers and Mr. Bremay, succeeded. Mr. Rogers, on gaining this station, was so nearly exhausted, that had his exertions been protracted only a few minutes longer, he must have sunk under them. He was now prevented from joining Mr. Meriden, by at least 20 men between them, none of whom could move, without the imminent peril of his life. They found that a very considerable number of the crew, seamen and soldiers, and some petty officers, were in the same situation as themselves, though many who had reached the rocks below, perished in attempting to ascend. They could yet discern some part of the ship, and in their dreary station solaced themselves with the hopes of its remaining entire until daybreak, for, in the midst of their own distress, the sufferings of the females on board affected them with the most poignant anguish, and every sea that broke inspired them with terror for their safety. But, alas, their apprehensions were too soon realized. Within a very few minutes of the time that Mr. Rogers gained the rock, an universal shriek, which long vibrated in their ears, in which the voice of female distress was lamentably distinguished, announced the dreadful catastrophe. In a few moments all was hushed, except the roaring of the winds and the dashing of the waves. The wreck was buried in the deep, and not an atom of it was ever afterwards seen. The most beautiful and affecting incident I know, associated with a shipwreck, succeeds this dismal story for a winter night. The Grosvenor, East Indiaman, homeward bound, goes ashore on the coast of Caffraria. It is resolved that the officers, passengers, and crew, in number 135 souls, shall endeavor to penetrate on foot, across trackless deserts, infested by wild beasts and cruel savages, to the Dutch settlements at the Cape of Good Hope. With this forlorn object before them, they finally separate into two parties, never more to meet on earth. There is a solitary child among the passengers, a little boy of 7 years old who has no relation there, and when the first party is moving away he cries after some member of it who has been kind to him. The crying of a child might be supposed to be a little thing to men in such great extremity, but it touches them, and he is immediately taken into that detachment. From which time forth, this child is sublimely made a sacred charge. He is pushed, on a little raft, across broad rivers by the swimming sailors, they carry him by turns through the deep sand and long grass, he patiently walking at all other times, they share with him such putrid fish as they find to eat, they lie down and wait for him when the rough carpenter, who becomes his especial friend, lags behind. Beset by lions and tigers, by savages, by thirst, by hunger, by death in a crowd of ghastly shapes, they never, O Father of all mankind, thy name be blessed for it. Forget this child. The captain stops exhausted, and his faithful coxswain goes back and is seen to sit down by his side, and neither of the two shall be any more beheld until the great last day, but, as the rest go on for their lives, they take the child with them. The carpenter dies of poisonous berries eaten in starvation, and the steward, succeeding to the command of the party, succeeds to the sacred guardianship of the child. God knows all he does for the poor baby, how he cheerfully carries him in his arms when he himself is weak and ill, how he feeds him when he himself is griped with want, how he folds his ragged jacket round him, lays his little worn face with a woman's tenderness upon his sunburnt breast, soothes him in his sufferings, sings to him as he limps along, unmindful of his own parched and bleeding feet. Divided for a few days from the rest, they dig a grave in the sand and bury their good friend the cooper, these two companions alone in the wilderness, and then the time comes when they both are ill, and beg their wretched partners in despair, reduced and few in number now, to wait by them one day. They wait by them one day, they wait by them 2 days. On the morning of the third, they move very softly about, in making their preparations for the resumption of their journey, for, the child is sleeping by the fire, and it is agreed with one consent that he shall not be disturbed until the last moment. The moment comes, the fire is dying, and the child is dead. His faithful friend, the steward, lingers but a little while behind him. His grief is great, he staggers on for a few days, lies down in the desert, and dies. But he shall be reunited in his immortal spirit, who can doubt it? With the child, when he and the poor carpenter shall be raised up with the words, "Inasmuch as ye have done it unto the least of these, ye have done it unto me." As I recall the dispersal and disappearance of nearly all the participators in this once famous shipwreck, a mere handful being recovered at last, and the legends that were long afterwards revived from time to time among the English officers at the Cape, of a white woman with an infant, said to have been seen weeping outside a savage hut far in the interior, who was whisperingly associated with the remembrance of the missing ladies saved from the wrecked vessel, and who was often sought but never found, thoughts of another kind of travel came into my mind. Thoughts of a voyager unexpectedly summoned from home, who traveled a vast distance, and could never return. Thoughts of this unhappy wayfarer in the depths of his sorrow, in the bitterness of his anguish, in the helplessness of his self-reproach, in the desperation of his desire to set right what he had left wrong, and do what he had left undone. For, there were many, many things he had neglected. Little matters while he was at home and surrounded by them, but things of mighty moment when he was at an immeasurable distance. There were many, many blessings that he had inadequately felt, there were many trivial injuries that he had not forgiven, there was love that he had but poorly returned, there was friendship that he had too lightly prized, there were a million kind words that he might have spoken, a million kind looks that he might have given, uncountable slight easy deeds in which he might have been most truly great and good. Oh, for a day, he would exclaim, for but one day to make amends. But the sun never shone upon that happy day, and out of his remote captivity he never came. Why does this traveler's fate obscure, on New Year's Eve, the other histories of travelers with which my mind was filled but now, and cast a solemn shadow over me? Must I one day make his journey? Even so. Who shall say, that I may not then be tortured by such late regrets, that I may not then look from my exile on my empty place and undone work? I stand upon a seashore, where the waves are years. They break and fall, and I may little heed them, but, with every wave the sea is rising, and I know that it will float me on this traveler's voyage at last. The begging letter writer. The amount of money he annually diverts from wholesome and useful purposes in the United Kingdom, would be a set off against the window tax. He is one of the most shameless frauds and impositions of this time. In his idleness, his mendacity, and the immeasurable harm he does to the deserving, dirtying the stream of true benevolence, and muddling the brains of foolish justices, with inability to distinguish between the base coin of distress, and the true currency we have always among us, he is more worthy of Norfolk Island than three-fourths of the worst characters who are sent there. Under any rational system, he would have been sent there long ago. I, the writer of this paper, have been, for some time, a chosen receiver of begging letters. For 14 years, My house has been made as regular a receiving house for such communications as any one of the great branch post offices is for general correspondence. I ought to know something of the begging letter writer. He has besieged my door at all hours of the day and night, he has fought my servant, he has lain in ambush for me, going out and coming in, he has followed me out of town into the country, he has appeared at provincial hotels, where I have been staying for only a few hours, he has written to me from immense distances, when I have been out of England. He has fallen sick, he has died and been buried, he has come to life again, and again departed from this transitory scene, he has been his own son, his own mother, his own baby, his idiot brother, his uncle, his aunt, his aged grandfather. He has wanted a greatcoat, to go to India in, a pound to set him up in life forever, a pair of boots to take him to the coast of China, a hat to get him into a permanent situation under government. He has frequently been exactly 7 and 6 pence short of independence. He has had such openings at Liverpool, posts of great trust and confidence in merchants' houses, which nothing but 7 and 6 pence was wanting to him to secure, that I wonder he is not mayor of that flourishing town at the present moment. The natural phenomena of which he has been the victim, are of a most astounding nature. He has had 2 children who have never grown up, who have never had anything to cover them at night, who have been continually driving him mad, by asking in vain for food, who have never come out of fevers and measles, which, I suppose, has accounted for his fuming his letters with tobacco smoke, as a disinfectant, who have never changed in the least degree through 14 long revolving years. As to his wife, what that suffering woman has undergone, nobody knows. She has always been in an interesting situation through the same long period, and has never been confined yet. His devotion to her has been unceasing. He has never cared for himself, he could have perished, he would rather, in short, but was it not his Christian duty as a man, a husband, and a father, to write begging letters when he looked at her? He has usually remarked that he would call in the evening for an answer to this question. He has been the sport of the strangest misfortunes. What his brother has done to him would have broken anybody else's heart. His brother went into business with him, and ran away with the money. His brother got him to be security for an immense sum and left him to pay it. His brother would have given him employment to the tune of hundreds a year, if he would have consented to write letters on a Sunday. His brother enunciated principles incompatible with his religious views, and he could not, in consequence, permit his brother to provide for him. His landlord has never shown a spark of human feeling. When he put in that execution I don't know, but he has never taken it out. The broker's man has grown gray in possession. They will have to bury him some day. He has been attached to every conceivable pursuit. He has been in the army, in the navy, in the church, in the law, connected with the press, the fine arts, public institutions, every description and grade of business. He has been brought up as a gentleman, he has been at every college in Oxford and Cambridge, he can quote Latin in his letters, but generally misspells some minor English word, he can tell you what Shakespeare says about begging, better than you know it. It is to be observed, that in the midst of his afflictions he always reads the newspapers, and rounds off his appeal with some allusion, that may be supposed to be in my way, to the popular subject of the hour. His life presents a series of inconsistencies. Sometimes he has never written such a letter before. He blushes with shame. That is the first time, that shall be the last. Don't answer it, and let it be understood that, then, he will kill himself quietly. Sometimes, and more frequently, he has written a few such letters. Then he encloses the answers, with an intimation that they are of inestimable value to him, and a request that they may be carefully returned. He is fond of enclosing something, verses, letters, pawnbrokers' duplicates, anything to necessitate an answer. He is very severe upon the pampered minion of fortune, who refused him the half-sovereign referred to in the enclosure number 2, but he knows me better. He writes in a variety of styles, sometimes in low spirits, sometimes quite jocosely. When he is in low spirits he writes downhill and repeats words, these little indications being expressive of the perturbation of his mind. When he is more vivacious, he is frank with me, he is quite the agreeable rattle. I know what human nature is, who better? Well. He had a little money once, and he ran through it, as many men have done before him. He finds his old friends turn away from him now, many men have done that before him too. Shall he tell me why he writes to me? Because he has no kind of claim upon me. He puts it on that ground plainly, and begs to ask for the loan, as I know human nature, of 2 sovereigns, to be repaid next Tuesday 6 weeks, before 12 at noon. Sometimes, when he is sure that I have found him out, and that there is no chance of money, he writes to inform me that I have got rid of him at last. He has enlisted into the company's service, and is off directly, but he wants a cheese. He is informed by the sergeant that it is essential to his prospects in the regiment that he should take out a single Gloucester cheese, weighing from 12 to 15 pounds. 8 or 9 shillings would buy it. He does not ask for money, after what has passed, but if he calls at 9, tomorrow morning may he hope to find a cheese? And is there anything he can do to show his gratitude in Bengal? Once he wrote me rather a special letter, proposing relief in kind. He had got into a little trouble by leaving parcels of mud done up in brown paper, at people's houses, on pretense of being a railway porter, in which character he received carriage money. This sportive fancy he expiated in the House of Correction. Not long after his release, and on a Sunday morning, he called with a letter, having first dusted himself all over, in which he gave me to understand that, being resolved to earn an honest livelihood, he had been travelling about the country with a cart of crockery. That he had been doing pretty well until the day before, when his horse had dropped down dead near Chatham, in Kent. That this had reduced him to the unpleasant necessity of getting into the shafts himself, and drawing the cart of crockery to London, a somewhat exhausting pull of 30 miles. That he did not venture to ask again for money, but that if I would have the goodness _ to leave him out a donkey _, he would call for the animal before breakfast. At another time my friend, I am describing actual experiences, introduced himself as a literary gentleman in the last extremity of distress. He had had a play accepted at a certain theatre, which was really open. Its representation was delayed by the indisposition of a leading actor, who was really ill, and he and his were in a state of absolute starvation. If he made his necessities known to the manager of the theatre, he put it to me to say what kind of treatment he might expect. Well, we got over the difficulty to our mutual satisfaction. A little while afterwards he was in some other strait. I think Mrs. Southcote, his wife, was in extremity, and we adjusted that point too. A little while afterwards he had taken a new house, and was going headlong to ruin for want of a water butt. I had my misgivings about the water butt, and did not reply to that epistle. But a little while afterwards, I had reason to feel penitent for my neglect. He wrote me a few broken-hearted lines, informing me that the dear partner of his sorrows died in his arms last night at 9 o'clock. I dispatched a trusty messenger to comfort the bereaved mourner and his poor children, but the messenger went so soon, that the play was not ready to be played out, my friend was not at home, and his wife was in a most delightful state of health. He was taken up by the Mendicity Society, informally it afterwards appeared, and I presented myself at a London police office with my testimony against him. The magistrate was wonderfully struck by his educational acquirements, deeply impressed by the excellence of his letters, exceedingly sorry to see a man of his attainments there, complimented him highly on his powers of composition, and was quite charmed to have the agreeable duty of discharging him. A collection was made for the poor fellow, as he was called in the reports, and I left the court with a comfortable sense of being universally regarded as a sort of monster. Next day comes to me a friend of mine, the governor of a large prison. "Why did you ever go to the police office against that man," says he, "without coming to me first? I know all about him and his frauds. He lodged in the house of one of my warders, at the very time when he first wrote to you, and then he was eating spring lamb at 18 pence a pound, and early asparagus at I don't know how much a bundle. On that very same day, and in that very same hour, my injured gentleman wrote a solemn address to me, demanding to know what compensation I proposed to make him for his having passed the night in a loathsome dungeon. And next morning an Irish gentleman, a member of the same fraternity, who had read the case, and was very well persuaded I should be chary of going to that police office again, positively refused to leave my door for less than a sovereign, and, resolved to besiege me into compliance, literally sat down before it for 10 mortal hours. The garrison being well provisioned, I remained within the walls, and he raised the siege at midnight with a prodigious alarum on the bell. The begging letter writer often has an extensive circle of acquaintance. Whole pages of the court guide are ready to be references for him. Noblemen and gentlemen write to say there never was such a man for probity and virtue. They have known him time out of mind, and there is nothing they wouldn't do for him. Somehow, they don't give him that £1.10 he stands in need of, but perhaps it is not enough, they want to do more, and his modesty will not allow it. It is to be remarked of his trade that it is a very fascinating one. He never leaves it, and those who are near to him become smitten with the love of it, too, and sooner or later set up for themselves. He employs a messenger, man, woman, or child. That messenger is certain ultimately to become an independent begging letter writer. His sons and daughters succeed to his calling, and write begging letters when he is no more. He throws off the infection of begging letter writing, like the contagion of disease. What Sydney Smith so happily called the dangerous luxury of dishonesty is more tempting, and more catching, it would seem, in this instance than in any other. He always belongs to a corresponding society of begging letter writers. Anyone who will, may ascertain this fact. Give money today in recognition of a begging letter, no matter how unlike a common begging letter, and for the next fortnight you will have a rush of such communications. Steadily refuse to give, and the begging letters become angels' visits, until the society is from some cause or other in a dull way of business, and may as well try you as anybody else. It is of little use inquiring into the begging letter writer's circumstances. He may be sometimes accidentally found out, as in the case already mentioned, though that was not the first inquiry made, but apparent misery is always a part of his trade, and real misery very often is, in the intervals of spring lemon early asparagus. It is naturally an incident of his dissipated and dishonest life. That the calling is a successful one, and that large sums of money are gained by it, must be evident to anybody who reads the police reports of such cases. But, prosecutions are of rare occurrence, relatively to the extent to which the trade is carried on. The cause of this is to be found, as no one knows better than the begging letter writer, for it is a part of his speculation, in the aversion people feel to exhibit themselves as having been imposed upon, or as having weakly gratified their consciences with a lazy, flimsy substitute for the noblest of all virtues. There is a man at large, at the moment when this paper is preparing for the press, on the 29th of April, 1850, and never once taken up yet, who, within these 12 months, has been probably the most audacious and the most successful swindler that even this trade has ever known. There has been something singularly base in this fellow's proceedings. It has been his business to write to all sorts and conditions of people, in the names of persons of high reputation and unblemished honor, professing to be in distress, the general admiration and respect for whom has ensured a ready and generous reply. Now, in the hope that the results of the real experience of a real person may do something more to induce reflection on this subject than any abstract treatise, and with a personal knowledge of the extent to which the begging letter trade has been carried on for some time, and has been for some time constantly increasing, the writer of this paper entreats the attention of his readers to a few concluding words. His experience is a type of the experience of many, some on a smaller, some on an infinitely larger scale. All may judge of the soundness or unsoundness of his conclusions from it. Long doubtful of the efficacy of such assistance in any case whatever, and able to recall but one, within his whole individual knowledge, in which he had the least after reason to suppose that any good was done by it, he was led, last autumn, into some serious considerations. The begging letters flying about by every post, made it perfectly manifest that a set of lazy vagabonds were interposed between the general desire to do something to relieve the sickness and misery under which the poor were suffering, and the suffering poor themselves. That many who sought to do some little to repair the social wrongs, inflicted in the way of preventable sickness and death upon the poor, were strengthening those wrongs, however innocently, by wasting money on pestilent knaves cumbering society. That imagination, soberly following one of these knaves into his life of punishment in jail, and comparing it with the life of one of these poor in a cholera-stricken alley, or one of the children of one of these poor, soothed in its dying hour by the late lamented Mr. Drouet, contemplated a grim farce, impossible to be presented very much longer before God or man. That the crowning miracle of all the miracles summed up in the New Testament, after the miracle of the blind seeing, and the lame walking, and the restoration of the dead to life, was the miracle that the poor had the gospel preached to them. That while the poor were unnaturally and unnecessarily cut off by the thousand, in the prematurity of their age, or in the rottenness of their youth, for a flower or blossom such youth has none, the gospel was not preached to them, saving in hollow and unmeaning voices. That of all wrongs, this was the first mighty wrong the pestilence warned us to set right. And that no post office order to any amount, given to a begging letter writer for the quieting of an uneasy breast, would be presentable on the last great day as anything towards it. The poor never write these letters. Nothing could be more unlike their habits. The writers are public robbers, and we who support them are parties to their depredations. They trade upon every circumstance within their knowledge that affects us, public or private, joyful or sorrowful. They pervert the lessons of our lives, they change what ought to be our strength and virtue into weakness, and encouragement of vice. There is a plain remedy, and it is in our own hands. We must resolve, at any sacrifice of feeling, to be deaf to such appeals, and crush the trade. There are degrees in murder. Life must be held sacred among us in more ways than one, sacred, not merely from the murderous weapon, or the subtle poison, or the cruel blow, but sacred from preventable diseases, distortions, and pains. That is the first great end we have to set against this miserable imposition. Physical life respected, moral life comes next. What will not content a begging letter writer for a week, would educate a score of children for a year? Let us give all we can, Let us give more than ever. Let us do all we can, let us do more than ever. But let us give, and do, with a high purpose, not to endow the scum of the earth, to its own greater corruption, with the offals of our duty. A child's dream of a star. There was once a child, and he strolled about a good deal, and thought of a number of things. He had a sister, who was a child too, and his constant companion. These two used to wander all day long. They wondered at the beauty of the flowers, they wondered at the height and blueness of the sky, they wondered at the depth of the bright water, they wondered at the goodness and the power of God who made the lovely world. They used to say to one another, sometimes, supposing all the children upon earth were to die, would the flowers, and the water, and the sky be sorry? They believed they would be sorry. For, said they, the buds are the children of the flowers, and the little playful streams that gambol down the hillsides are the children of the water, and the smallest bright specks playing at hide and seek in the sky all night, must surely be the children of the stars, and they would all be grieved to see their playmates, the children of men, no more. There was one clear shining star that used to come out in the sky before the rest, near the church spire, above the graves. It was larger and more beautiful, they thought, than all the others, and every night they watched for it, standing hand in hand at a window. Whoever saw it first cried out, "I see the star." And often they cried out both together, knowing so well when it would rise, and where. So they grew to be such friends with it, that, before lying down in their beds, they always looked out once again, to bid it good night, and when they were turning round to sleep, they used to say, "God bless the star." But while she was still very young, oh, very, very young, the sister drooped, and came to be so weak that she could no longer stand in the window at night, and then the child looked sadly out by himself, and when he saw the star, turned round and said to the patient pale face on the bed, "I see the star." And then a smile would come upon the face, and a little weak voice used to say, "God bless my brother and the star." And so the time came all too soon. When the child looked out alone, and when there was no face on the bed, and when there was a little grave among the graves, not there before, and when the star made long rays down towards him, as he saw it through his tears. Now, these rays were so bright, and they seemed to make such a shining way from earth to heaven, that when the child went to his solitary bed, he dreamed about the star, and dreamed that, lying where he was, he saw a train of people taken up that sparkling road by angels. And the star, opening, showed him a great world of light, where many more such angels waited to receive them. All these angels, who were waiting, turned their beaming eyes upon the people who were carried up into the star, and some came out from the long rows in which they stood, and fell upon the people's necks, and kissed them tenderly, and went away with them down avenues of light, and were so happy in their company, that lying in his bed he wept for joy. But, there were many angels who did not go with them, and among them one he knew. The patient face that once had lain upon the bed was glorified and radiant, but his heart found out his sister among all the host. His sister's angel lingered near the entrance of the star, and said to the leader among those who had brought the people thither, "Is my brother come?" And he said no. She was turning hopefully away, when the child stretched out his arms, and cried, "Oh, sister, I am here. Take me." And then she turned her beaming eyes upon him, and it was night, and the star was shining into the room, making long rays down towards him as he saw it through his tears. From that hour forth, the child looked out upon the star as on the home he was to go to, when his time should come, and he thought that he did not belong to the earth alone, but to the star too, because of his sister's angel gone before. There was a baby born to be a brother to the child, and while he was so little that he never yet had spoken word, he stretched his tiny form out on his bed, and died. Again the child dreamed of the open star, and of the company of angels, and the train of people, and the rows of angels with their beaming eyes all turned upon those people's faces. Said his sister's angel to the leader, "Is my brother come?" And he said, "Not that one, but another." As the child beheld his brother's angel in her arms, he cried, "Oh, sister, I am here. Take me." And she turned and smiled upon him, and the star was shining. He grew to be a young man, and was busy at his books when an old servant came to him and said, "Thy mother is no more. I bring her blessing on her darling son." Again at night he saw the star, and all that former company. Said his sister's angel to the leader, "Is my brother come?" And he said, "Thy mother." A mighty cry of joy went forth through all the star, because the mother was reunited to her two children. And he stretched out his arms and cried, "Oh, mother, sister, and brother, I am here. Take me." And they answered him, "Not yet," and the star was shining. He grew to be a man, whose hair was turning gray, And he was sitting in his chair by the fireside, heavy with grief, and with his face bedewed with tears, when the star opened once again. Said his sister's angel to the leader, "Is my brother come?" And he said, "Nay, but his maiden daughter." And the man who had been the child saw his daughter, newly lost to him, a celestial creature among those three, and he said, "My daughter's head is on my sister's bosom, and her arm is around my mother's neck, and at her feet there is the baby of old time, and I can bear the parting from her, God be praised." And the star was shining. Thus the child came to be an old man, and his once smooth face was wrinkled, and his steps were slow and feeble, and his back was bent. And one night as he lay upon his bed, his children standing round, he cried, as he had cried so long ago, "I see the star." They whispered one another, "He is dying." And he said, "I am. My age is falling from me like a garment, and I move towards the star as a child. And oh, my father, now I thank thee that it has so often opened, to receive those dear ones who await me." And the star was shining, and it shines upon his grave, our English watering place. In the autumn time of the year, when the great metropolis is so much hotter, so much noisier, so much more dusty or so much more water carted, so much more crowded, so much more disturbing and distracting in all respects, than it usually is, a quiet sea beach becomes indeed a blessed spot. Half awake and half asleep, this idle morning in our sunny window on the edge of a chalk cliff in the old-fashioned watering place to which we are a faithful resorter, we feel a lazy inclination to sketch its picture. The place seems to respond. Sky, sea, beach, and village lie as still before us as if they were sitting for the picture. It is dead low water. A ripple plays among the ripening corn upon the cliff, as if it were faintly trying from recollection to imitate the sea, and the world of butterflies hovering over the crop of radish seed are as restless in their little way as the gulls are in their larger manner when the wind blows. But the ocean lies winking in the sunlight like a drowsy lion, its glassy waters scarcely curve upon the shore, the fishing boats in the tiny harbor are all stranded in the mud, our two colliers, our watering place has a maritime trade employing that amount of shipping, have not an inch of water within a quarter of a mile of them, and turn, exhausted, on their sides, like faint fish of an antediluvian species. Rusty cables and chains, ropes and rings, undermost parts of posts and piles and confused timber defenses against the waves, lie strewn about, in a brown litter of tangled seaweed and fallen cliff which looks as if a family of giants had been making tea here for ages, and had observed an untidy custom of throwing their tea leaves on the shore. In truth, our watering place itself has been left somewhat high and dry by the tide of years. Concerned as we are for its honor, we must reluctantly admit that the time when this pretty little semicircular sweep of houses, tapering off at the end of the wooden pier into a point in the sea, was a gay place, and when the lighthouse overlooking it shone at daybreak on company dispersing from public balls, is but dimly traditional now. There is a bleak chamber in our watering place which is yet called the assembly rooms, and understood to be available on hire for balls or concerts, and, some few seasons since, an ancient little gentleman came down and stayed at the hotel, who said that he had danced there, in bygone ages, with the Honorable Miss Peepy, well known to have been the beauty of her day and the cruel occasion of innumerable jewels. But he was so old and shriveled, and so very rheumatic in the legs, that it demanded more imagination than our watering place can usually muster, to believe him, therefore, except the master of the rooms, who to this hour wears knee breeches, and who confirmed the statement with tears in his eyes, nobody did believe in the little lame old gentleman, or even in the Honorable Miss Peepy, long deceased. As to subscription balls in the assembly rooms of our watering place now, red-hot cannon balls are less improbable. Sometimes, a misguided wanderer of a ventriloquist, or an infant phenomenon, or a juggler, or somebody with an orrery that is several stars behind the time, takes the place for a night, and issues bills with the name of his last town lined out, and the name of ours ignominiously written in, but you may be sure this never happens twice to the same unfortunate person. On such occasions the discolored old billiard table that is seldom played at, unless the ghost of the Honorable Miss Peepy plays at pool with other ghosts, is pushed into a corner, and benches are solemnly constituted into front seats, back seats, and reserve seats, which are much the same after you have paid, and a few dull candles are lighted, wind permitting, and the performer and the scanty audience play out a short match which shall make the other most low-spirited, which is usually a drawn game. After that, the performer instantly departs with maledictory expressions, and is never heard of more. But the most wonderful feature of our assembly rooms, is, that an annual sale of fancy and other china, is announced here with mysterious constancy and perseverance. Where the china comes from, where it goes to, why it is annually put up to auction when nobody ever thinks of bidding for it, How it comes to pass that it is always the same china, whether it would not have been cheaper, with the sea at hand, to have thrown it away, say in 1830, are standing enigmas. Every year the bills come out, every year the master of the rooms gets into a little pulpit on a table, and offers it for sale, every year nobody buys it, every year it is put away somewhere till next year, when it appears again as if the whole thing were a new idea. We have a faint remembrance of an unearthly collection of clocks, purporting to be the work of Parisian and Genovese artists, chiefly bilious-faced clocks, supported on sickly white crutches, with their pendulums dangling like lame legs, to which a similar course of events occurred for several of years, until they seemed to lapse away, of mere imbecility. Attached to our assembly rooms is a library. There is a wheel of fortune in it, but it is rusty and dusty, and never turns. A large doll, with movable eyes, was put up to be raffled for, by 25 members at 2 shillings, 7 years ago this autumn, and the list is not full yet. We are rather sanguine, now, that the raffle will come off next year. We think so, because we only want 9 members, and should only want 8, but for number 2 having grown up since her name was entered, and withdrawn it when she was married. Down the street, there is a toy ship of considerable burden, in the same condition. 2 of the boys who were entered for that raffle have gone to India in real ships, since, and 1 was shot, and died in the arms of his sister's lover, by whom he sent his last words home. This is the library for the Minerva Press. If you want that kind of reading, come to our watering place. The leaves of the romances, reduced to a condition very like curl paper, are thickly studded with notes in pencil, sometimes complimentary, sometimes jocose. Some of these commentators, like commentators in a more extensive way, quarrel with one another. One young gentleman who sarcastically writes O, after every sentimental passage, is pursued through his literary career by another, who writes insulting beast. Miss Julia Mills has read the whole collection of these books. She has left marginal notes on the pages, as is not this truly touching? J. M. How thrilling. J. M. Entranced here by the magician's potent spell. J. M. She has also italicized her favorite traits in the description of the hero, as his hair, which was underscore dark underscore and underscore wavy underscore, clustered in underscore rich profusion underscore around a underscore marble brow underscore, whose lofty paleness bespoke the intellect within. It reminds her of another hero. She adds, how like BL can this be, mere coincidence? J. M. You would hardly guess which is the main street of our watering place, but you may know it by its being always stopped up with donkey chaises. Whenever you come here, and see harnessed donkeys eating clover out of barrows drawn completely across a narrow thoroughfare, you may be quite sure you are in our high street. Our police you may know by his uniform, likewise by his never on any account interfering with anybody, especially the tramps and vagabonds. In our fancy shops we have a capital collection of damaged goods, among which the flies of countless summers have been roaming. We are great in obsolete seals, and in faded pincushions, and in rickety camp stools, and in exploded cutlery, and in miniature vessels, and in stunted little telescopes, and in objects made of shells that pretend not to be shells. Diminutive spades, barrows, and baskets, are our principal articles of commerce, but even they don't look quite new somehow. They always seem to have been offered and refused somewhere else, before they came down to our watering place. Yet, it must not be supposed that our watering place is an empty place, deserted by all visitors except a few staunch persons of approved fidelity. On the contrary, the chances are that if you came down here in August or September, you wouldn't find a house to lay your head in. As to finding either house or lodging of which you could reduce the terms, you could scarcely engage in a more hopeless pursuit. For all this, you are to observe that every season is the worst season ever known, and that the householding population of our watering place are ruined regularly every autumn. They are like the farmers, in regard that it is surprising how much ruin they will bear. We have an excellent hotel, capital baths, warm, cold, and shower, first-rate bathing machines, and as good butchers, bakers, and grocers, as heart could desire. They all do business, it is to be presumed, from motives of philanthropy, but it is quite certain that they are all being ruined. Their interest in strangers, and their politeness under ruin, bespeak their amiable nature. You would say so, if you only saw the baker helping a newcomer to find suitable apartments. So far from being at a discount as to company, we are in fact what would be popularly called rather a knobby place. Some tip-top knobs come down occasionally, even dukes and duchesses. We have known such carriages to blaze among the donkey chaises, as made beholders wink. Attendant on these equipages come resplendent creatures in plush and powder, who are sure to be stricken disgusted with the indifferent accommodation of our watering place, and who, of an evening, particularly when it rains, may be seen very much out of drawing, in rooms far too small for their fine figures, looking discontentedly out of little back windows into by streets. The lords and ladies get on well enough and quite good-humoredly, but if you want to see the gorgeous phenomena who wait upon them at a perfect nonplus, you should come and look at the resplendent creatures with little back parlors for servants' halls, and turn up bedsteads to sleep in, at our watering place. You have no idea how they take it to heart. We have a pier, a queer old wooden pier, fortunately without the slightest pretensions to architecture, and very picturesque in consequence. Boats are hauled up upon it, ropes are coiled all over it, lobster pots, nets, masts, oars, spars, sails, ballast, and rickety capstans, make a perfect labyrinth of it. Forever hovering about this pier, with their hands in their pockets, or leaning over the rough bulwark it opposes to the sea, gazing through telescopes which they carry about in the same profound receptacles, are the boatmen of our watering place. Looking at them, you would say that surely these must be the laziest boatmen in the world. They lounge about, in obstinate and inflexible pantaloons that are apparently made of wood, the whole season through. Whether talking together about the shipping in the channel, or gruffly unbending over mugs of beer at the public house, you would consider them the slowest of men. The chances are 1,000 to 1 that you might stay here for 10 seasons, and never see a boatman in a hurry. A certain expression about his loose hands, when they are not in his pockets, as if he were carrying a considerable lump of iron in each, without any inconvenience, suggests strength, but he never seems to use it. He has the appearance of perpetually strolling, running is too inappropriate a word to be thought of, to seed. The only subject on which he seems to feel any approach to enthusiasm, is pitch. He pitches everything he can lay hold of, the pier, the palings, his boat, his house. When there is nothing else left he turns to and even pitches his hat, or his rough weather clothing. Do not judge him by deceitful appearances. These are among the bravest and most skillful mariners that exist. Let a gale arise and swell into a storm, let a sea run that might appall the stoutest heart that ever beat, let the light boat on these dangerous sands throw up a rocket in the night, or let them hear through the angry roar the signal guns of a ship in distress, and these men spring up into activity so dauntless, so valiant, and heroic, that the world cannot surpass it. Cavillers may object that they chiefly live upon the salvage of valuable cargoes. So they do, and God knows it is no great living that they get out of the deadly risks they run. But put that hope of gain aside. Let these rough fellows be asked, in any storm, who volunteers for the lifeboat to save some perishing souls, as poor and empty-handed as themselves, whose lives the perfection of human reason does not rate at the value of a farthing each, and that boat will be manned, as surely and as cheerfully, as if 1,000 pounds were told down on the weather-beaten pier. For this, and for the recollection of their comrades whom we have known, whom the raging sea has engulfed before their children's eyes in such brave efforts, whom the secret sand has buried, we hold the boatmen of our watering place in our love and honor, and are tender of the fame they well deserve. So many children are brought down to our watering place that, when they are not out of doors, as they usually are in fine weather, it is wonderful where they are put, the whole village seeming much too small to hold them under cover. In the afternoons, you see no end of salt and sandy little boots drying on upper windowsills. At bathing time in the morning, the little bay re-echoes with every shrill variety of shriek and splash, after which, if the weather be at all fresh, the sands teem with small blue mottled legs. The sands are the children's great resort. They cluster there, like ants, so busy burying their particular friends, and making castles with infinite labor which the next tide overthrows, that it is curious to consider how their play, to the music of the sea, foreshadows the realities of their after lives. It is curious, too, to observe a natural ease of approach that there seems to be between the children and the boatmen. They mutually make acquaintance, and take individual likings, without any help. You will come upon one of those slow heavy fellows sitting down patiently mending a little ship for a mite of a boy, whom he could crush to death by throwing his lightest pair of trousers on him. You will be sensible of the oddest contrast between the smooth little creature, and the rough man who seems to be carved out of hard-grained wood, between the delicate hand expectantly held out, and the immense thumb and finger that can hardly feel the rigging of thread they mend, between the small voice and the gruff growl, and yet there is a natural propriety in the companionship, always to be noted in confidence between a child and a person who has any merit of reality and genuineness, which is admirably pleasant. We have a preventive station at our watering place, and much the same thing may be observed, in a lesser degree, because of their official character, of the coast blockade, a steady, trusty, well-conditioned, well-conducted set of men, with no misgiving about looking you full in the face, and with a quiet thoroughgoing way of passing along to their duty at night, carrying huge sou'wester clothing in reserve, that is fraught with all good prepossession. They are handy fellows, neat about their houses, industrious at gardening, would get on with their wives, one thinks, in a desert island, and people it, too, soon. As to the naval officer of the station, with his hearty fresh face, and his blue eye that has pierced all kinds of weather, it warms our hearts when he comes into church on a Sunday, with that bright mixture of blue coat, buff waistcoat, black neckerchief, and gold epaulette, that is associated in the minds of all Englishmen with brave, unpretending, cordial, national service. We like to look at him in his Sunday state, and if we were First Lord, really possessing the indispensable qualification for the office of knowing nothing whatever about the sea, we would give him a ship tomorrow. We have a church, by the by, of course, a hideous temple of Flynn, like a great petrified haystack. Our chief clerical dignitary, who, to his honor, has done much for education both in time and money, and has established excellent schools, is a sound, shrewd, healthy gentleman, who has got into little occasional difficulties with the neighboring farmers, but has had a pestilent trick of being right. Under a new regulation, he has yielded the church of our watering place to another clergyman. Upon the whole, we get on in church well. We are a little bilious sometimes, about these days of fraternization, and about nations arriving at a new and more unprejudiced knowledge of each other, which our Christianity don't quite approve, but it soon goes off, and then we get on very well. There are two dissenting chapels, besides, in our small watering place, being in about the proportion of 120 guns to a yacht. But the dissension that has torn us lately, has not been a religious one. It has arisen on the novel question of gas. Our watering place has been convulsed by the agitation, gas or no gas. It was never reason why no gas, but there was a great no gas party. Broadsides were printed and stuck about, a startling circumstance in our watering place. The no gas party rested content with chalking no gas. And down with gas. And other such angry war whoops, on the few back gates and scraps of wall which the limits of our watering place afford. But the gas party printed and posted bills, wherein they took the high ground of proclaiming against the no gas party, that it was said let there be light and there was light, and that not to have light, that is gaslight, in our watering place, was to contravene the great decree. Whether by these thunderbolts or not, the no gas party were defeated, and in this present season we have had our handful of shops illuminated for the first time. Such of the no gas party, however, as have got shops, remain in opposition and burn tallow, exhibiting in their windows the very picture of the sulkiness that punishes itself, and a new illustration of the old adage about cutting off your nose to be revenged on your face, in cutting off their gas to be revenged on their business. Other population than we have indicated, our watering place has none. There are a few old used-up boatmen who creep about in the sunlight with the help of sticks, and there is a poor imbecile shoemaker who wanders his lonely life away among the rocks, as if he were looking for his reason, which he will never find. Sojourners in neighboring watering places come occasionally in flies to stare at us, and drive away again as if they thought us very dull. Italian boys come, punch comes, the fantoxini come, the tumblers come, the Ethiopians come, glee singers come at night, and hum and vibrate, not always melodiously, under our windows. But they all go soon, and leave us to ourselves again. We once had a traveling circus and Womwell's menagerie at the same time. They both know better than ever to try it again. And the menagerie had nearly raised us from the face of the earth in getting the elephant away, his caravan was so large, and the watering place so small. We have a fine sea, wholesome for all people, profitable for the body, profitable for the mind. The poet's words are sometimes on its awful lips. And the stately ships go on to their haven under the hill, but oh for the touch of a vanished hand. And the sound of a voice that is still. Break, 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 at the foot of thy crags, O sea. But the tender grace of a day that is dead will never come back to me. Yet it is not always so, for the speech of the sea is various, and wants not abundant resource of cheerfulness, hope, and lusty encouragement. And since I have been idling at the window here, the tide has risen. The boats are dancing on the bubbling water, the colliers are afloat again, the white-bordered waves rush in, the children do chase the ebbing Neptune, and do fly him when he comes back. The radiant sails are gliding past the shore. And shining on the far horizon, all the sea is sparkling, heaving, swelling up with life and beauty, this bright morning. Our French watering place. Having earned, by many years of fidelity, the right to be sometimes inconstant to our English watering place, we have dallied for two or three seasons with a French watering place, once solely known to us as a town with a very long street, B. beginning with an abattoir and ending with a steamboat, which it seemed our fate to behold only at daybreak on winter mornings, when, in the days before continental railroads, just sufficiently awake to know that we were most uncomfortably asleep, it was our destiny always to clatter through it, in the coupe of the diligence from Paris, with a sea of mud behind us, and a sea of tumbling waves before. In relation to which latter monster, our mind's eye now recalls a worthy Frenchman in a sealskin cap with a braided hood over it, once our traveling companion in the coupe aforesaid, who, waking up with a pale and crumpled visage, and looking ruefully out at the grim row of breakers enjoying themselves fanatically on an instrument of torture called the bar, inquired of us whether we were ever sick at sea. Both to prepare his mind for the abject creature we were presently to become, and also to afford him consolation, we replied, "Sir, your servant is always sick when it is possible to be so." He returned, altogether uncheered by the bright example, "Ah, heaven, but I am always sick, even when it is impossible to be so." The means of communication between the French capital and our French watering place are wholly changed since those days, but the channel remains unbridged as yet, and the old floundering and knocking about go on there. It must be confessed that saving in reasonable, and therefore rare, sea weather, the act of arrival at our French watering place from England is difficult to be achieved with dignity. Several little circumstances combine to render the visitor an object of humiliation. In the first place, the steamer no sooner touches the port, then all the passengers fall into captivity, being boarded by an overpowering force of custom house officers, and marched into a gloomy dungeon. In the second place, the road to this dungeon is fenced off with ropes breast high, and outside those ropes all the English in the place who have lately been seasick and are now well, assemble in their best clothes to enjoy the degradation of their dilapidated fellow creatures. Oh, my gracious! How ill this one has been! Here's a damp one coming next. Here's a pale one. Oh! Ain't he green in the face, this next one? Even we ourselves, not deficient in natural dignity, have a lively remembrance of staggering up this detested lane one September day in a gale of wind, when we were received like an irresistible comic actor, with a burst of laughter and applause, occasioned by the extreme imbecility of our legs. We were coming to the third place. In the third place, the captives, being shut up in the gloomy dungeon, are strained, two or three at a time, into an inner cell, to be examined as to passports, and across the doorway of communication, stands a military creature making a bar of his arm. Two ideas are generally present to the British mind during these ceremonies. First, that it is necessary to make for the cell with violent struggles, as if it were a lifeboat and the dungeon a ship going down. Secondly, that the military creature's arm is a national affront, which the government at home ought instantly to take up. The British mind and body becoming heated by these fantasies, delirious answers are made to inquiries, and extravagant actions performed. Thus, Johnson persists in giving Johnson as his baptismal name, and substituting for his ancestral designation the National Dam. Neither can he by any means be brought to recognize the distinction between a portmanteau key and a passport, but will obstinately persevere in tendering the one when asked for the other. This brings him to the fourth place, in a state of mere idiocy, and when he is, in the fourth place, cast out at a little door into a howling wilderness of touters, he becomes a lunatic with wild eyes and floating hair until rescued and soothed. If friendless and unrescued, he is generally put into a railway omnibus and taken to Paris. But our French watering place, when it is once got into, is a very enjoyable place. It has a varied and beautiful country around it, and many characteristic and agreeable things within it. To be sure, it might have fewer bad smells and less decaying refuse, and it might be better drained, and much cleaner in many parts, and therefore infinitely more healthy. Still, it is a bright, airy, pleasant, cheerful town, and if you were to walk down either of its three well-paved main streets, towards 5 o'clock in the afternoon, when delicate odors of cookery fill the air, and its hotel windows, it is full of hotels, give glimpses of long tables set out for dinner, and made to look sumptuous by the aid of napkins folded fanwise, you would rightly judge it to be an uncommonly good town to eat and drink in. We have an old walled town, rich in cool public wells of water, on the top of a hill within and above the present business town, and if it were some hundreds of miles further from England, instead of being, on a clear day, within sight of the grass growing in the crevices of the chalk cliffs of Dover, you would long ago have been bored to death about that town. It is more picturesque and quaint than half the innocent places which tourists, following their leader like sheep, have made impostors of. To say nothing of its houses with grave courtyards, its queer by corners, and its many-windowed streets wide and quiet in the sunlight, there is an ancient belfry in it that would have been in all the annuals and albums, going and gone, these 100 years if it had but been more expensive to get at. Happily it has escaped so well, being only in our French watering place, that you may like it of your own accord in a natural manner, without being required to go into convulsions about it. We regard it as one of the later blessings of our life, that Bilkins, the only authority on taste, never took any notice that we can find out, of our French watering place. Bilkins never wrote about it, never pointed out anything to be seen in it, never measured anything in it, always left it alone. For which relief, heaven bless the town and the memory of the immortal Bilkins likewise. There is a charming walk, arched and shaded by trees, on the old walls that form the four sides of this high town, whence you get glimpses of the streets below, and changing views of the other town and of the river, and of the hills and of the sea. It is made more agreeable and peculiar by some of the solemn houses that are rooted in the deep streets below, bursting into a fresher existence atop, and having doors and windows, and even gardens, on these ramparts. A child going in at the courtyard gate of one of these houses, climbing up the many stairs, and coming out at the fourth floor window, might conceive himself another Jack, alighting on enchanted ground from another beanstalk. It is a place wonderfully populous in children, English children, with governesses reading novels as they walk down the shady lanes of trees, or nursemaids interchanging gossip on the seats, French children with their smiling bonnets and snow-white caps, and themselves, if little boys, in straw headgear like beehives, work baskets and church hassocks. 3 years ago, there were three weazen old men, one bearing a frayed red ribbon in his threadbare buttonhole, always to be found walking together among these children, before dinner time. If they walked for an appetite, they doubtless lived and pension, were contracted for, otherwise their poverty would have made it a rash action. They were stooping, blear-eyed, dull old men, slipshod and shabby, in long-skirted short-waisted coats and meager trousers, and yet with a ghost of gentility hovering in their company. They spoke little to each other, and looked as if they might have been politically discontented if they had vitality enough. Once, we overheard Red Ribbon feebly complain to the other two that somebody, or something, was a robber, and then they all three set their mouths so that they would have ground their teeth if they had had any. The ensuing winter gathered Red Ribbon onto the great company of faded ribbons, and next year the remaining two were there, getting themselves entangled with hoops and dolls, familiar mysteries to the children, probably in the eyes of most of them, harmless creatures who had never been like children, and whom children could never be like. Another winter came, and another old man went, and so, this present year, the last of the triumvirate, left off walking, it was no good, now, and sat by himself on a little solitary bench, with the hoops and the dolls as lively as ever all about him. In the placed arm of this town, a little decayed market is held, which seems to slip through the old gateway, like water, and go rippling down a hill, to mingle with the murmuring market in the lower town, and get lost in its movement and bustle. It is very agreeable on an idle summer morning to pursue this market stream from the hilltop. It begins, dozingly and dully, with a few sacks of corn, starts into a surprising collection of boots and shoes, goes brawling down the hill in a diversified channel of old cordage, old iron, old crockery, old clothes, civil and military, old rags, new cotton goods, flaming prints of saints, little looking glasses, and incalculable lengths of tape, dives into a back way, keeping out of sight for a little while, as streams will, or only sparkling for a moment in the shape of a market drinking shop, and suddenly reappears behind the great church, shooting itself into a bright confusion of white-capped women and blue-bloused men, poultry, vegetables, fruits, flowers, pots, pans, praying chairs, soldiers, country butter, umbrellas and other sunshades, girl porters waiting to be hired with baskets at their backs, and one weazen little old man in a cocked hat, wearing a cuirass of drinking glasses and carrying on his shoulder a crimson temple fluttering with flags, like a glorified pavior's rammer without the handle, who rings a little bell in all parts of the scene, and cries his cooling drink hola, hola, ho-o-o, in a shrill cracked voice that somehow makes itself heard, above all the chaffering and bending hum. Early in the afternoon, the whole course of the stream is dry. The praying chairs are put back in the church, the umbrellas are folded up, the unsold goods are carried away, the stalls and stands disappear, the square is swept, the hackney coaches lounge there to be hired, and on all the country roads, if you walk about, as much as we do, you will see the peasant women, always neatly and comfortably dressed, riding home, with the pleasantest saddle furniture of clean milk pails, bright butter kegs, and the like, on the jolliest little donkeys in the world. We have another market in our French watering place, that is to say, a few wooden hutches in the open street, down by the port, devoted to fish. Our fishing boats are famous everywhere, and our fishing people, though they love lively colors, and taste is neutral, see Bilkins, are among the most picturesque people we ever encountered. They have not only a quarter of their own in the town itself, but they occupy whole villages of their own on the neighboring cliffs. Their churches and chapels are their own, they consort with one another, they intermarry among themselves, their customs are their own, and their costume is their own and never changes. As soon as one of their boys can walk, he is provided with a long bright red nightcap, and one of their men would as soon think of going afloat without his head, as without that indispensable appendage to it. Then, they wear the noblest boots, with the hugest tops, flapping and bulging over anyhow, above which, they encase themselves in such wonderful overalls and petticoat trousers, made to all appearance of tarry old sails, so additionally stiffened with pitch and salt, that the wearers have a walk of their own, and go straddling and swinging about among the boats and barrels and nets and rigging, a sight to see. Then, their younger women, by dint of going down to the sea barefoot, to fling their baskets into the boats as they come in with the tide, and bespeak the first fruits of the haul with propitiatory promises to love and marry that dear fisherman who shall fill that basket like an angel, have the finest legs ever carved by nature in the brightest mahogany, and they walk like Juno. Their eyes, too, are so lustrous that their long gold earrings turn dull beside those brilliant neighbors, and when they are dressed, what with these beauties, and their fine fresh faces, and their many petticoats, striped petticoats, red petticoats, blue petticoats, always clean and smart, and never too long, and their homemade stockings, mulberry-colored, blue, brown, purple, lilac, which the older women, taking care of the Dutch-looking children, sit in all sorts of places knitting, knitting, knitting from morning to night,